Hello and welcome to Perfect Dive, the podcast. I'm Ben Mail, one of your hosts, and I'm here with my co-host. Not with, because we're still in a pandemic and we're not assholes and we're responsible. We're not in the same room. I'm actually sitting in my car right now doing this podcast while my neighbors stare at me, but it's fine because I'm here for you people. Matt, are you here?
I am here. I can't promise we're not assholes, but I can promise we are very far away.
Yeah. Matt was like, Ben, why don't you do the intro today? And I'm like, well, it's going to be a disaster. Here we are.
But people tune in to hear disasters, like watching a car crash. They can't look away.
Yes. And they also tune in to hear our like weird auto-tuned voices every 15 seconds sometimes.
Or when they miss complete sentences that we say, but they still tune in and listen. And I think you did a pretty good job for the opening, Ben. Don't knock yourself.
Oh, I don't care. I'm proud that we're even doing this in a pandemic and giving people some entertainment. So it's all good. And imagine how good this is going to be when we're actually in the same room doing this with a guest.
I wonder if it'll be any better than it is now. I feel like we're getting our flow down. I feel like we're doing better not stepping on each other's toes. But it will be wonderful to be in the same room, that's for sure.
Yeah, it probably won't be better, but it's fine.
So, Ben, today is a very big day throughout the world. It is Pac-Man's 40th birthday.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy to think about? Like, one of the most iconic video games of all time is 40 years old.
That's so weird because I guess I'm getting to the age now where I hear something like that, like a statistic or an achievement in time, and I think about where I was and how old I was when that happened, and I'm starting to feel my age, and I never did before. And like, my nephew was talking to my brother and he asked him if he could watch The Last Dance with him, and I was just thinking to myself, like, I was surprised that my nephew cared about Michael Jordan, because Michael Jordan's so much older than my nephew. But my nephew likes basketball and he likes LeBron James and he likes the NBA now, so I guess that makes sense. And then I started to think, like, I remember my dad telling me about Phil Jackson and Dave DeBuscher and, you know, some of the, you know, Earl the Pearl Monroe and Walt Frazier and, like, some of the most iconic Knicks, you know, when he was a fan. And I was just thinking, like, those guys are so much ahead of my time, and now I'm becoming that person. It's like, oh, you should check out, you like Michael Jordan, you may also like.
Well, I saw just on Twitter just now, there was a picture of what looked like a mid-90s goth team, and the tweet was talking about how our generation looks at the Gen Z as like, and yet they were the ones wearing Janko jeans and black eyeliner. And so Pac-Man turning 40, so you were what, -4? I was -5. Do you remember your first Pac-Man experience? Do you remember your first playing an arcade game?
No, I don't remember my first Pac-Man experience. I think I'd be lying if I said I did. I remember my first video game experience, but it wasn't Pac-Man. And I remember when I think the first time I ever played Pac-Man, I must have been like 7 or 8 or 9, somewhere in there. And thinking it was like the hardest game in the world. Like, I couldn't figure out how to avoid those ghosts. And I just felt like they were always mocking me when they would make that, like, you know, that crunching noise when they would eat you and they would just kind of flash on the screen. I just felt like so worthless.
Did you ever play Intellivision? Have you ever even heard of Intellivision?
I vaguely remember this. I think somebody brought this up a few months ago when I was hanging out, and I kind of remember it, but I don't.
So my first ever video game experience was at my parents' friends, the Rinks. And they had this old TV in the basement, and attached to the TV was what looked like an odd-looking kind of VCR. Think of almost like a Sega Genesis, a V1 Sega Genesis, and you would pop in the particular game. And what was so cool was each game had its own slides for the controller. And so you would actually layer on your controller for that specific I remember playing a very, very early version of Tanks and absolutely loving it. And then probably within a year or two, my parents and I visited my uncle in Colorado, and my mind was blown when I went in the basement and they had the first Nintendo and the first version of Super Mario Brothers. This must have been, I don't know, 91, 92. And I was absolutely in heaven, but we couldn't afford it. And my parents didn't get me a video game system until Super Nintendo, probably 3 or 4 years later.
Wow. That's crazy.
What was your favorite Super Nintendo game?
See, here's the thing. I didn't really play Super Nintendo that much. My brother and I got Nintendo when it first came out. And it was like a
high class, huh?
Well, I think it was because, you know, we didn't really have much growing up. And then, you know, we got that and it was like the biggest deal in the world. And we thought our parents were so cool for getting that for us that we didn't want to ask for anything ever again because that was like a big deal. And two, we played that Nintendo out. I think we must have played it well into, I think we played it so long that we didn't even mess with Super Nintendo. Like the next video game system we got was Sega Genesis because we had played Nintendo until we completely maxed it out. And there was just, I think the new technology with Sega had come out. I don't even remember playing any games for Super Nintendo ever.
Oh, wow. So Super Nintendo was our jam. I know a lot of my close friends from home. But I remember in middle school, my great friend Steve Britt and I would literally, and Nick Rising, we would literally, and I'm just playing Super Mario Kart over and over again on Super Nintendo.
Yeah, I think I went to like friends' houses to play it, but I didn't own it. And I remember like a lot of Nintendo games because I played Nintendo a lot, but I didn't play too much Super Nintendo. My brother and I loved Sega. I think that's kind of like what we did. We would like skip a generation of video game systems. Like we had Nintendo, then we had Sega Genesis, then we had that for a long time. Then I think we went right to like, maybe we did, I think we had Sega Dreamcast for a short stint. And then we went through like PlayStation, and we were like a PlayStation family. So we didn't do Xbox. We did PlayStation 1, 2, and I think 3. And then that was it. I stopped playing video games a long time ago. But I recently came across this ad on Instagram for this kind of Super Nintendo / Nintendo looking machine where you have every game ever.
Doesn't Adam have that? Isn't that what we were playing NBA Jam on?
Adam, our good friend who was on the podcast talking about The Last Dance, he has it, and I played it at his house, and that's what made me pull the trigger on it because it's incredible. He's the one who turned me on to it.
Oh, it's so good. Actually, speaking of Sony and PlayStation, they just revealed some of, I think, the mock-ups for PlayStation 5. Who knows with Corona when it's going to be released, but supposedly released at the end of the calendar year. And so a little stock tip for you. I figured Sony stock for the next couple of years is probably going to rise because they're going to sell a shit ton of PlayStation 5. So quick tip for you.
You know what's so funny? I don't play video games at all. And I mean, I'm going to when I get this thing, of course, but I've always wanted to play video games even into my, I don't know, like I would say like my whole, I stopped playing like in my mid 20s and I haven't played in a long time, but I've always wanted to play, but I would feel guilty that if I was spending time playing video games, I was not working on my writing or working on my stand up or, you know, things that I'm interested in. And I'm so jealous of people who aren't hard on themselves and can just sit down and play video games for a few hours or whatever and feel great about the experience, because I'll play if I play and I'm like, damn it, I could be writing jokes right now. What am I doing trying to beat Pac-Man? I'm a fucking grown-ass man. This is a waste of my time.
Oh, see, I don't really feel that way at all. I think anything that gives you a little bit of a release and a time off from what you're working on is a good thing. Video games now in competition over the past 6 weeks, but that is a very basic chess game. We have been playing a shit ton of chess, and I'm probably playing 3 to 5 games a day. And I really look at that as more of an intellectual challenge, and starting off not being very good and getting my ass beat, and then taking some of the lessons and playing some harder opponents, and kind of working my way up to be mediocre at best.
Right.
We also learned how to play backgammon. So we have a backgammon board in the house, and we just kept on looking at it. And then finally, we decided to play. And then just like in your and I first game, beat me. And when I played backgammon with Lucy, she beat me. So I surround myself with balance. I think that's a key.
Yeah, I when I was a kid, my grandmother taught my brother and I backgammon. And then my brother's obsessed with it. He loves it. And I could give a shit about backgammon. I've never liked it. I don't like it. I'm going to go on record and saying I still don't understand it. And I don't understand the appeal of it. But I've always liked chess. I've always liked chess, and I've never been good at it. And all the advice I've ever gotten in chess is like, you know, think ahead, see the board, make moves. A few in advance, and I don't listen. I just go fast and loose, and we're going one at a time, and I'm gonna put pressure on you and fly by the seat of my pants, and I usually don't win, but I have fun.
It is enjoyable. So just to end on the video games for a second, what is your favorite video game of all time?
Yeah, that's a good question. Shit, man. I have a few. I feel like I'm going to go for each system that I had. But ooh, I'll say my favorite one of all time is Super Mario Brothers 3.
Mm.
I just feel like that game like was so revolutionary at the time and so fun, and you can play it over and over, and there was, you know, a few different outcomes, not a lot, but there was just enough to keep it interesting, and you could fly and be a raccoon and you know, shoot, you know, flaming spitballs out of your nose. It was just something about it that's just, it's just instant nostalgia for me. It makes me think of like when I was a kid, and that was a real happy moment in time. So I'll go with that. But then I would say, like, for Sega Genesis, the game Contra.
Ooh.
I spent hours playing that game, man. That was like the first time my brother and I would share the video game system, and it wasn't a competition, because usually we would play, you know, sports games, like we played NHL 94 or Madden, or you know games where we compete, and it got really intense. And that was like the first video game I felt like, oh man, we're in this together, like it's us against this world, this fictional world of aliens and monsters or whatever we were fighting in that game. And then Virtua Tennis for Dreamcast was amazing.
Oh wow, I remember playing that with you in college.
Remember that? yeah that was a great game. PlayStation 1, I'm gonna say probably Madden, because it's just, that's when it got really good, where you could, you know, make a juke move to the right or the left, and it got more, a little more realistic, and it was a lot of fun. And I guess I'll stop there, because I usually just played Madden and other games on PlayStation 2. I didn't try anything too out there.
All right, let's go as I go through these systems for. For Nintendo, I fucking love Duck Hunt. Man, I could play Duck Hunt for hours. So Duck Hunt for Nintendo. Super Nintendo, I'll actually go with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
That was a great game, too.
I think it was whatever the second one was. For Sega, I'm going to go with Sonic or Echo the Dolphin. Did you ever play Echo?
No, I don't think I don't remember that.
So I actually played this in the lobby of the dentist's office. Echo was this dolphin that you basically just flew around in the ocean, swam around in the ocean, and sent out your sonar signal. And it was almost like, what's the little Tamagotchi thing? It was almost like a pet you needed to keep alive, and it would go on these cool missions. So I'll go with that. And then for Dreamcast, gotta be NBA 2K2. Has to be. And then Xbox, I'll go with Halo. And I just need to tell this Halo story. And I know you've heard it so many times, but for the audience, I hope they'll appreciate.
Yeah,
so we were in college, and we would all play Halo on Xbox Live. And we were pretty good over some time. And so we would all gather around the TV and play. And then, of course, we were on our microphone talking shit to these 13-year-olds back and forth. And there was one kid that kept on popping up, and his name was Shanipa. And so every time Shanipa would hop on, because he didn't have a microphone, everybody would talk shit to Shanipa. Oh, fuck you, Shanipa. We hate you, Shanipa. And over weeks and weeks of playing with this kid, he finally comes up, and he now has a microphone, little symbol. were like, oh, hey, Shanipa, fuck you, Shanipa, we hate you, Shanipa. And he goes, my name's not Shanipa, I'm Shane from PA.
What a letdown that must have been.
Oh my God, we fucking died. Were you there? Do you remember that?
I remember hearing the story. I don't know if I was in the room, but I definitely remember hearing the story a lot.
Oh my God, that was the best. So jokeland. How's stand up writing going? how's stand up writing going?
Live from jokeland. No, it's going well actually. I have been very prolific. I made the decision early on with this pandemic to treat it more of a blessing than a curse, because I'm fortunate enough to, you know, to not have my living taken away from me like a lot of people. So instead of complaining about, you know, oh man, I got to stay at home, I thought, okay, what's a way I can be productive and not complain, because I'm in a really fortunate situation. So, you know, I had booked this Amazon stand-up show right before the pandemic hit, and then so this got pushed back, and so I have a set dedicated for that I've been doing around town for like 18 months, which is polished, and it's usually my A material, and that's going to be about 10 to 12 minutes. So I was like, okay, why don't I write more new stuff, because I want to be ready when clubs open up and when I can start doing stand-up again to do all new stuff and really have a lot of time. So my goal was to write 20 to 30 new minutes, which it takes time to create new minutes when you're a stand-up, because a lot of people think you just write a joke and then that's the joke. But the truth is, you're more like a scientist where you try it in the lab, but then you have to actually test it out and get real world reactions, which is why audiences are so important for live comedy, because they will let you know very quickly if your joke sucks or it's really funny. And so,
yeah, you actually had, sorry to interrupt, but you actually had, and I don't know if you broke it down scientifically, but I think you had something along the lines of like how many times you needed to get up with the new material to get a new minute or something.
Yeah. So, you know, I've long before I started doing stand-up, I've only been doing stand-up for a short time, but I've always wanted to do it. Like, I think since I was 16, I just didn't have the balls, and it took me a long time to get up the courage to do it. And there were a few detours in my life, which is fine, but I never stopped studying the art of stand-up. And I think that's why I've been able to have some success quickly, is because I've been studying this for a long time. And, you know, I would listen to guys like Seinfeld and Joe Rogan and, you know, Bill Hicks and Bill Burr and, you know, Tom Segura and all different types of comedians, and, you know, listen to how they talked about it, not just their own stand-up, which I do listen to, but like how they talk about creating and crafting new material and how often you have to fail before you can succeed. And so it's kind of like baseball in the same sense, where if in baseball you get up 10 times and you strike out 7 times, you're a Hall of Famer because you're hitting 300. But you know, it's daunting because you're focusing on those 7 strikeouts and you're like, damn, you know, I didn't do so well. But if you look at a guy like Reggie Jackson, I think he had more strikeouts than he had hits.
Wow.
Right? But he's a Hall of Famer because, you know, he's hit tons and tons of home runs, he's won championships, and he was a great ball player. So I think for me, for every, let's say for every 10 jokes I write, maybe one or two of them is good. And I don't mean good like they're not funny on paper. They're fine on paper. They won't work in stand-up. And I think there's something to be said about writing jokes versus performing jokes. When you write a joke and it's funny on paper, usually I find it will not work as well on the stage, because that means it's meant to be read, not performed and heard. Stand-up is an auditory medium, meaning you're listening. You're not saying. So I have to understand that it's going to take you a beat or half a beat or 2 beats, depending on the person, to really get what I'm saying. So I have to be able to communicate this very clearly and effectively, and then use my personality to be funny and make it funny. So if I write it on paper and I try too hard to write down something funny on paper, I personally find that it's not funny when I perform it. But if I go up there kind of with like a loose idea that has the right beats of a good joke, then I'm going to make it funny on stage.
Well, that's what I find so interesting about kind of watching your arc or your path, is you kind of started off in writing with the short stories. Then you went to kind of the screenwriting, and now you're doing more of the stand-up, adding on now the TV and film writing. And each one of these mediums, you really need to use a different part of your brain, because as you said, you know, the written word really doesn't come off on stage, but a traditional written word, as if we're writing a novel or a short story, doesn't work in a movie script.
Absolutely. I kind of feel, for a long time, I felt really bummed out that I didn't start stand-up earlier, because I would have loved to. But now when I think about it, I'm kind of grateful, because I went in this long circle to get to stand-up, you know, like starting with the short stories and writing tons and tons and tons of film scripts and then learning television and all that. But now I just feel like I have all these tools in my tool belt where I'm able to kind of oscillate different parts of my brain depending on what I'm working on. Because, you know, you're right, like you said, writing a TV script and writing a film script are entirely different. Writing a great joke that's just meant for Twitter or a text message is totally different from trying to write out stand-up. Performing stand-up is totally different than acting. And you know, learning that a little bit was very humbling. So I just feel grateful that I'm able to learn a lot of these disciplines and challenge myself. You know, my real passion is stand-up. That's my favorite, and that will be my favorite. But I do think it's necessary to learn all these skills, because it's good to just have these skills, because we're in an age of, you know, if you create your own content, the sky's the limit. You can literally do whatever you want as long as people are into what you're doing.
And that's kind of the mission of Three Mighty Lions, our overall production company, is to have unparalleled quality when it comes to our content. You've always taken a lead on the content and creative side, and I've taken a lead more on the business side. And as we've discussed, I'm trying to up-level my skills in the creative, as trying to give you an inside look into the business, so that we're both multifaceted. Can be dangerous. And so as I'm getting kind of the one-on-one into screenwriting, as you're a master, and vice versa in the business. And so Jonathan, our mentor, who was on a couple of episodes ago, he kept on recommending this book, Story, by Robert McKee. And Story is all about both the history of storytelling and the needed structure for screenwriting and script writing. And it builds a lot on Joseph Campbell's story circle that we had talked about. And we had spent a lot of time talking about The Last Dance. And this article came out on The Ringer, one of my favorite websites. And I just wanted to read it to you because it's so perfect in how it takes Jordan and his arc in The Last Dance and puts it into kind of the story that we've been discussing. And so I'll just read this quickly, but so much of our perception of Jordan as a player is shaped by the myth surrounding him. His career was essentially the hero's journey popularized by Joseph Campbell and Star Wars come to life. The hero proves the doubters, the coach who cut him in high school, the team who passed on him in the draft, wrong on his quest for greatness. But he must defeat the ruthless villain, the Bad Boy Pistons, to become a champion. So he enlists the help of a Yoda-like mentor, Phil Jackson, who imparts life lessons in the form of arcane knowledge passed down from the ancient masters, the Triangle Offense. Unseen forces then drag him away at the height of his powers, his first retirement, and he returns from a period of self-reflection, his baseball excursion, to vanquish his challengers once more, the second three-peat, and leave as the undisputed champion, the greatest who is, was, and is to come. Has there ever been better story circle than Jordan's career arc?
Well, that's pretty cool. I'm a huge fan of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, and then eventually Dan Harmon and his story circle. I think that's such a what Dan Harmon did to break down Joseph Campbell and create a more digestible version of this, I think really revolutionized storytelling and screenwriting. And I've recommended it to a lot of my friends who are interested in screenwriting and story and things like that, because Robert McKee, his work is genius, but it's very dense, and it's hard to extrapolate some of the things, because sometimes it feels like conflicting information, even though it's not. Once you start to actually understand it on a deeper level, it's very it almost becomes like the more you learn, the simpler you have to get. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But well, with Dan Harmon's version, it kind of takes you through these 8 beats and makes it easier for you to kind of lay a foundation for your understanding and your learning. And he even talks about, I think I read one post that he blogged years ago about how a great story is like a sports team, you know, and it's like, I like to think about it like, remember when LeBron James was on the Cavaliers and they were down 3-1 against Golden State?
Yeah.
So to me, that's the greatest accomplishment in sports history, in my opinion, because he was playing a team that had just won 70 games in the regular season that was as good, arguably, as the Bulls Jordan team in 96.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, 96, I think, right? And he is playing against the MVP of the league. He is leading his team and the other team in every single category.
Yeah.
They go into Golden State and win, and they force a game 6. They win a game 6, force a game 7, and then they are down 5. I think they were down 5 points in the last 2 minutes. He blocks Iguodala off the backboard. They come down, score. Then Irving hits that 3, and they wind up winning the game. So it's just that's basically, well, think about it. That's basically a great epic story, right? You have this hero who wants something. LeBron James wants a championship for the city of Cleveland because it would mean so much to them, right? And he grew up there. He's the hometown kid, right? That's the setup. That's your act one right there.
Yeah.
Okay. Then he goes to Cleveland, and it's hard, and there's trials and tribulations. Kevin Love can't stay healthy. Kyrie Irving can't stay healthy. LeBron's on an island by himself. Finally, they rally together. They're healthy. They have a great season. They get to the playoffs. They beat everybody. Now they're up against this opponent that there's no way anyone thinks they can beat. They go down 3-1. Everything looks like it's lost. They have this kind of soul-searching moment. They rally the troops. They come back. They win 2 games in a row. They force a game 7, but there's no way they'll win in Golden State in game 7. Now they're playing great, but they are down 5 points with 2 minutes to go, and it looks like it's over once Iguodala steals the ball. Then out of nowhere, LeBron James turns into Batman, blocks the ball, they score, they wind up overcoming this, you know, immovable opponent, and they win. That's screenwriting right there. Like, that is a great story.
Oh, it literally gives me chills. I remember watching that, and you talked about LeBron leading the teams. I mean, literally led both teams in categories.
Yeah.
Points, rebounds, steals. Has never happened. But yeah, you were talking about Robert McKee and kind of the depth, and at first glance, not really understanding the depth, but then as it goes, really simplifying everything. So one of the notes that I made, and this really took me a while to wrap my arms around and mind around, characterization. The definition that Robert talks about is the sum of all observable information about their values, their education, their accent, etc. But true character is only expressed through choices under pressure. Are they honest or a liar? Are they loving or cruel? Has to witness them making choices under pressure in pursuit of their desire. How they choose is who they are. It's so interesting to think about, I'm setting it up in description versus I'm showing it in action. And the choices, giving your protagonist the choices to uncover that true character, I think is so profound and something that I really need to spend time learning and trying and testing out.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. And I think that one of the best pieces of advice I ever got with writing is that character and creating good characters is all about their behavior. And their behavior is shown through their choices. So if you put characters in a position where they have to make choices, now we're showing their character traits, we're showing who they are. And that's really what we tune in for television or film to see, is what choice are you going to make in this situation, right?
Mm.
Whether it's a sitcom, right, situational comedy, or a drama, we want to see the choices you're going to make. We want to see what Walter White's going to do when he finds out he's got cancer and he doesn't have the money to help himself. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what defines the whole series, right? So I love that. And that's why those books are so great.
Yeah.
I've been writing since I'm 16. So for me, I can always fail upwards and learn and learn and learn and learn. And that's why, you know, now almost 40 years old, I can I can remember things and call upon things I've learned in writing, and that's why I'm able to get it now. But for you, you don't come from a writing background. You come from a sales background and a business background. So, like, what's this transition been like for you, you know, going from, hey, you know, me saying to you, hey, I need you to be my business partner because I have all these great ideas, and you going, okay, and doing it part-time, to now we're doing this full-time, and you're learning how to write and produce?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think something that I probably don't spend enough time actually thinking about. My initial reaction is that when it comes to my goal, it is to make my grandparents' film. And so as I took on this challenge, I actually thought that I was going to be writing a novel. When I traveled to Vienna, Shanghai, it was really just to take notes on the background for me to start writing the story. And I actually did write the first third of the novel in a hotel room in Shanghai. I've never really considered myself a writer. And even in writing the novel, I didn't really think that I would be the one to actually write it. It would be more hire a writer to get the story out of me, and we'll work together to do that. What really was the transformation point for me, I think, is thanks to our great friend, Chris Eaton. Chris actually encouraged and even begged me to read and do this book called The Artist's Way. And The Artist's Way is all about discovering your inner artist and getting over whatever blockages you have to create. And because I never considered myself an artist, I actually didn't have all the baggage that comes with being a struggling artist or having all these blockages. But instead, the process was every day doing what's called morning pages, 3 handwritten pages a day about absolutely anything. The only rule is you have to do it every day. And I've always been, as you know, a talker. And if it was in sales, if it was in Connecticut School of Broadcasting, it's always been my voice that's speaking aloud. What I learned in The Artist's Way was that I can actually have my voice come out in my writing. And that was the first kind of checkpoint of like, oh, wait, I can actually read this back and it actually makes sense. And once I realized that I can translate to the written word, then it was just a matter of learning the process. And that's been the toughest part, is not to say, hey, can you put words on a page? But can you put words in a page that fit with the 100-year-old process of screenwriting? And I'd also say that you're kind of the perfect partner for me, because I think intuitively I understand story a little bit. I understand characters. I try to have an emotional connection with who and what I'm watching. You and say, hey, Ben, I have these 3 or 5 ideas, and you could say, oh, that one sucks. That one's really good. Oh, why don't we spend time here? And then I discover what your process is and how you would bring it to life. And then I can start to mimic that. So I feel like I'm always flying with a parachute. And hopefully that answers it for you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think for me, you know, I always had confidence that you would figure it out because you're very smart, but also your work ethic is, you know, unparalleled. So I was confident you'd figure it out. I never really thought how hard the transition must be, because I didn't go from doing something completely different and then jumping into this world. I was always kind of adjacent to this world. My whole, you know, starting in my adolescence, wanting to write, watching film, studying. And even stand-up is very parallel to all this. So I appreciate the challenges of going from a traditional business background to now, okay, you're in this kind of beast of a world in Hollywood where, yeah, business rules definitely help you and things like that, but you also have to have a knack for storytelling or the arts if you are going to write or even produce.
Yeah, and I do think that the only way truly grow is when you're faced with something you're not really good at, and you have to try and fail. And so for me, the biggest thing is I have to swallow my fucking pride. Yes, I've been successful in sales. Yes, I've been successful in here or there, but I am not a screenwriter. I am not a high quality screenwriter. But what I am is somebody who's willing to learn, who's willing to fail. And with a mentor like Jonathan and a partner like you, I could actually share what happened last week. So as we've talked about in the past, I've been trying to work on some scenes for my grandparents' story, and I've really been struggling with this characterization versus character. I'm telling you too much about the character, but not giving them obstacles that they need to face to reveal who they really are. And actually last Friday, I finally got the okay from Jonathan that I built a scene that actually works. And that is because I gave my grandfather an obstacle, and how he reacted to that obstacle tells the audience about his character. And that's the first time I've ever been able to put those pieces together. And again, this doesn't happen without trying and failing for the past couple of months, and also swallowing my pride to say, hey, Ben, I'm not just going to stay in my business lane, and you're not just going to stay in the creative lane. We're going to switch sides so that we're both well-rounded and better off.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a huge part of this business, is just basically being humbled nonstop.
Yes. And yeah, why don't we bring up the last piece before we let the audience go? And that is actually what happened in the past 2 weeks. So we've been working on this dark comedy, and we had written out the first act and the beats of what we think we were, what works. And we actually had our characters going through these interesting events, and actually making some choices. And we built it out where we know what their value systems are in the beginning. We know what their objective is of the scene. And then the change, positive or negative, based on the value at the end of the scene. And so we were pretty excited. We shared this with Jonathan yesterday. And very quickly, he does what he did what he does. And that is say, guys, I don't give a shit about these characters. I am not emotionally invested in them. Yes, interesting things happen, but I don't care. What was that like for you? And how do we always kind of find ourselves in a position where we take one step forward, one step back, but then come back to the drawing board to move the needle?
Yeah, I think it's just basically you have to test things out, see how they work, and then find out what works and what doesn't. And fortunately for us, we have someone who's able to prevent us from thinking we're on the right track this whole time, and then sending it out into the world and letting the market tell us, hey, this really sucks. or potential investors turning us down or things like that. So it can be frustrating, but it's really a gift because he's able to tell us and diagnose what works and what doesn't, or why something works very quickly, and allow us to make the necessary adjustments to have some success.
Yeah, I don't think that we can, well, I won't say this on record, Jonathan, if you're listening, go on, turn it down. But no, we couldn't pay this man enough for the intelligence he provides for us. And we always talk about he's giving us the structure that we can then rinse and repeat 100 times. And so thank you, Jonathan. You can listen again. Thank you, Chris, for the artist way. And thank you, Ben, for just being a partner, and the best partner as we take on this journey of Hollywood and life together. And yeah, thank you all so much for listening.
My pleasure. And I'll keep doing those intros. I know you guys are going to appreciate it.
Love it. Have a great day, guys.
Bye.